Today on Think Twice, from the Dayton Metro Library's Social Justice Speaker Series, a conversation regarding the landmark 1954 civil rights legislation, Brown versus Board of Education. Dayton Metro Library's Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Director, Dr. Carlos Marshall, talks with Cheryl Brown Henderson, daughter of the lead plaintiff in the case, Oliver Brown. This is an edited conversation from the event, which took place on May 30th at the Main Library in downtown Dayton.
The Dayton Metro Library Social Justice Speaker Series is an ongoing initiative to bring some of the world's most prominent authors, creatives, scholars, activists, and practitioners to Montgomery County. At the library, cultivating spaces for courageous conversations and intergroup dialogue where everyone is free to belong is core to our values of equity, diversity, and inclusion. The Social Justice Speaker Series places an emphasis on supporting diverse voices, groups, and change agents that come from marginalized backgrounds that have been systematically disenfranchised from the literary canon, publishing industry, cultural and creative scenes, dominant discourses, and beyond. The series aspires to be a springboard for a learning community of social justice warriors, advocates, and allies with an eye towards inclusive excellence. This event was made possible with the generosity of the Friends of the Dayton Metro Library and the Charles F. Kettering Foundation. Cheryl Brown Henderson, one of the three daughters of the late Reverend Oliver L. Brown, who in the fall of 1950, along with 12 other parents of Topeka, Kansas, led by attorneys for the NAACP, filed suit on behalf of their children against the local Board of Education. Their case joined with cases from Delaware, South Carolina, Virginia, Washington, D.C., on appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court on May 17, 1954, which became known as a landmark decision, Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. This case was legally named for Oliver L. Brown. Brown died in 1961 before knowing the impact this case would have on the nation. Cheryl is the founding president of the Brown Foundation for Educational Equity, Excellence, and Research, and owner of Brown & Associates Educational Consulting Firm. She has an extensive background in education, business, and civic leadership, having served and chaired on various local, state, and national boards. In addition, she has 2 decades of experience in political advocacy, public policy implementation, and federal legislation development. She has received an honorary doctorate of humane letters from Washburn University and an honorary doctorate of education from the University of South Florida. In 1988, she founded the Brown Foundation. Since its establishment, the foundation has provided scholarships to more than 100 minority students, presented awards to local, state, and national leaders, established libraries for children in low-income communities, developed curriculum on Brown for educators across the country, and created traveling exhibits. In 1990, under her leadership, the foundation successfully worked with the U.S. Congress to establish the Brown v. Board of Education National Park in Topeka, which opened in May of 2004. In 2001, under her leadership, the foundation successfully worked with the U.S. Congress to establish the Brown v. Board of Education 50th Anniversary Presidential Commission. Cheryl has been invited to the White House on 7 occasions. So please help me give a warm Montgomery County welcome to Cheryl Brown Henderson. Well, thank you so much for being here. It's an absolute honor, privilege to have this critical conversation and dialogue with you on such a watershed moment for the nation as well as the world. You know, I really want to dig right into this and really set the table for everybody here in terms of some of the details around Brown versus Board of Education, particularly in this era where we live with hyper-visibility to misinformation and disinformation. You have been noted in talking about kind of the ways that the historical legacy of Brown versus Board has been skewed. So I'm wondering if you can just provide detail to us here today about Brown 101, if you will, and how the case came to be about and the various different sequencing that happened and how media played a role in that.
Absolutely. Yeah, the one thing I'll start out with, which will be evident in a moment, is we've all learned that if you don't tell your own story, somebody else will. And it won't look anything like your truth. And Brown versus the Board of Education is kind of a case study, you know, an example of that very thing. Disinformation is something that we all use now, but it has followed us for 70 years. Years ago, and our family didn't discover this until the 80s, people have always come to us believing that Brown v. Board of Education was something my father did. That's number one. And they've come to us believing that my sister, who's now passed on, Linda, was the center of Brown v. Board of Education, neither of which is true. Brown v. Board was a collective action, and it was a movement, much like the civil rights movement. But I like to go clear back to 105 years earlier, when this nation witnessed its first school desegregation case, 1849, in Roberts versus the City of Boston. So this is pre-Civil War, that African Americans, recognizing the power of education, began to litigate around this issue of not having access to the same kind and quality education that white children had been afforded. So you fast forward 105 years later to May 17, 1954, when Earl Warren announced its opinion. I go back again, because most people don't look at Kansas, my home state, as a consequential place when it comes to civil rights. How many of you have ever been to Kansas, even? Raise your hand. Okay. Now, I have to always ask a follow-up question. Did you stop? Because a lot of people drive through my home state and they assert that they have been to Kansas. Kansas is one of those extremely consequential states when it comes to civil rights, school desegregation, those issues. But let me start with the fact that Kansas halted the westward expansion of slavery at its borders. Bleeding Kansas, John Brown, and all of the activity that happened that when Missouri tried to encroach on our state and tried to bring the institution of slavery into Kansas, it was stopped at our borders. That's number one. Secondly, Kansas is the only state in the country that has litigated 11 school desegregation cases before Brown v. Board of Education. The first school deseg case in Kansas was in 1881, Tenon versus Ottawa School Board. And on our website, brownvboard.org, all of those early cases have been scanned into our website. So if you're curious about those 11 cases, what the circumstances were, what happened, you can actually read the case transcripts. The interesting thing about Kansas, the legislature at the time, they passed legislation that said cities of 15,000 or larger could have segregated schools, but only at the elementary level. So when Brown was being organized, ending up in the Supreme Court, we were only talking about three cities in the whole state: Wichita, Kansas City, and Topeka. Many of those early cases were successful because they were brought from cities that were fewer than 15,000. Now, I'm not saying any of this made sense, because a lot of what we've witnessed in terms of denial of opportunity and segregation and discrimination and all these behaviors, they don't make sense. So I'm not saying it makes sense, but this is how the Kansas legislature decided to deal with the issue of public education. So three of those early cases were in Topeka. So there were three cases against the Topeka Board of Education before Brown v. Board. So I just want you to get the lay of the land. So for us living in Kansas, this was nothing new. So when people scratch their heads as to why on earth is Topeka, Kansas on the end of Brown v. Board, it is because Kansas has been consequential and very progressive, well, it used to be, leading up to that era. We used to export a socialist paper out of Garnett, Kansas. You know, so many things have changed over the years. And finally, Kansas was a state that actually sent emissaries to the South after the Civil War to recruit African Americans, formerly enslaved people, to come live in Kansas, promising homesteading and certain freedoms that they were still not being afforded post-Civil War in the South. So I'm telling you all this to lead up to what happened in Topeka with Brown v. Board. So now you've got the history lesson, and now you'll stop in Kansas, won't you? So Brown v. Board, Topeka. In 1948, on the heels of the 11th case in Kansas, McKinley Burnett, who was the president of the Topeka NAACP, made a decision. He calculated, strategized. We're going to try this one more time. This time, we're going to go to federal court. We're not going to stop in state Supreme Court. But we need plaintiffs. So together with the three attorneys for the NAACP, Charles Scott, his brother John Scott, their partner Charles Bledsoe, they decided they would have a big recruitment campaign. So Mr. Burnett began by simply going to every school board meeting, trying to convince the Board of Education to just integrate their elementary schools. It was a choice. It was not a requirement in the state. You were permitted, not required. Not luck. No luck after 2 years of doing that. So he warned them that they had had 2 years to prepare for what's coming. So in the summer of 1950, the legal team that I mentioned, together with the secretary, Lucinda Todd, spread out across the city of Topeka, going to churches, talking to friends, talking to family members who were African American, people that had children in elementary school, because remember, we're talking elementary schools. Junior highs and high schools were integrated. My mother went to integrated junior high and high school, and she talks about how academics were integrated all day long. Students were in class together. But when it came to prom, when it came to extracurricular activities, there were even two basketball teams, two cheerleading squads. So again, none of this made sense, but this is how Topeka handled the issue, the social issue of integration. So when this didn't happen, Mr. Burnett, his team spread out across town, one of them came to our home. So literally, history knocked on our door. So Charles Scott, my dad's friend, who was one of the attorneys, asked my father, called on friendship, if he would be willing to be a plaintiff in Brown, well, it wasn't Brown v. Board, a plaintiff in the case they were organizing. We do believe that it may have been all women, because when they came to our home, there were nine people who had already signed on, nine women, married women who were homemakers. So for my father, it was kind of a, are you going to recruit any more dads? And he was concerned about perhaps ended up being the only dad. I jokingly say that my mother in our family would likely have stepped up to be a plaintiff, but she was expecting, and her favorite child had to get here. So she could not do that, because at the time, pregnant women didn't go out and about so much. So long story short, in the fall of 1950, they had assembled a group of 13 parents representing 19 children who were the plaintiffs in Brown v. Board of Education. The parents were the plaintiffs on behalf of their children. So much to my dad's chagrin, he was the only dad. So when the case was filed in February 1951, it was then called Oliver L. Brown et al., meaning and others, versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. People ask us, you know, and have really engaged in conjecture that perhaps it was named for Oliver Brown because of the alphabet. No. It was named for Oliver Brown because of his gender. When you look at the roster of litigants on our website, you will see that Darlene Brown, equal in every way in terms of being a plaintiff, but alphabetically first. D comes before O. But he was the only man. And we figure gender politics of the late 40s and early 1950s, somebody, either as a legal strategy or the clerk of the court, we really don't know why it ended up being named for him, except for gender. And we don't know in what way gender played a role. If it was strategic, if it was simply, you know, back in the day when men used to be really important. Either one of those things, we're not sure which. But it ended up being named for him. So maybe it wasn't such a short story, but that's how it ended up being organized in Topeka and ended up being named for my father.
As you alluded to, history knocking on your door steps, literally, I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit more. What was the specific motivation behind your father and your mother presumably agreeing to just become at that time just one of the many other plaintiffs that were already on the case other than your father's friendship with one of the lawyers?
Now, that's a good question, because you figure in that era, you know, any time you took a public stand against Jim Crow, you were taking a risk. You know, not perhaps so much in Kansas, but definitely across the South. The other thing I'll say in Topeka, we lived in integrated neighborhoods. So Kansas did make good on recruiting African Americans into the state, and there was a certain level of equality. So our neighborhoods were integrated, but the odd thing about that was our white neighbors living right next door, kids played together all evening, all summer, but in the morning when the school bell rang, you know, my sisters went one way, and their white friends living next door went another way. So it wasn't a matter of not always already associating. Workplaces were integrated. The only vestiges of Jim Crow were department stores and some restaurants. But that's, you know, how it was, how we lived in Topeka. It was, you know, it was kind of a contradictory, ambivalent situation. So my mother, who is now 103 and very healthy 103-year-old, thank you. I'll tell her you applauded. And she, I just came back from Kansas about a week ago, and we laugh about the fact that that is one woman. If you want to go someplace and you're thinking it might not be easier for her to go, don't say it in front of her, because she'll want to go, and she will go. So I love that she's so healthy at 103. So she's persuasive. And my father was studying for the ministry. He became an African Methodist Episcopal pastor in 1953, the year before Brown was decided. But he was studying, you know, working all day as a welder for the Santa Fe Railroad in the shops. My parents had owned a restaurant together with my mother's cousins, and it was called Cousins. How creative. And so they shut down the restaurant so he could work all day and then go to Washburn in the evenings in preparation for becoming a pastor. So she had to persuade him, you know, because he looked at this as, you know, one more thing. You know, my plate is full. But her argument was, you're stepping out to be a leader. Ministers are considered leaders in their community. You're going to be leading a congregation. This is something you should do, not just for our children, but for our community. So that's really, you know, her persuasion is what convinced him to go ahead and sign on.
Talking about the social integration of the local level in Topeka as well as other places nationally, I'm wondering if you could talk about how Brown v. Board also set a precedent for a number of other Supreme Court decisions, such as the 1964 Civil Rights Act, 1965 Voting Rights Act, and then 1968, the Housing Rights Act. Mm-hmm. As you have been noted in saying, and I quote, ironically, Brown versus Board holds more resonance in other sectors of society. For example, every time a person of color checks into a hotel or is served at a restaurant. However, the Brown decision does not resonate as resoundingly in public education, mm-hmm. where it was intended to have its greatest impact.
The internet. Once you quote it, it's out there. So you're absolutely right, and I do believe that. I believe it because in the wake of Brown v. Board, the pushback started rather immediately, and it hasn't stopped to this day. The pushback coming from Congress, let me give you that example. Nearly 100 elected officials in Congress wrote a document called The Doctrine of Constitutional Principles, but colloquially known as the Southern Manifesto. Worth reading online, believe me. Basically, they said that as congressional reps, House and Senate, they were going to do everything in their power to overturn, reverse the court's decision. They went on to make it clear that any school district in their district across the South planning to defy the court's decision, don't worry, we have your back. The state of Virginia, you know, led by the governor, reinforced by his congressional reps in the House and the Senate, instituted a plan of vouchers, sound familiar, so that white parents would have a way to ensure their children did not have to go to school with African American children. He went on to penalize school districts in Virginia that were planning to comply with the court's decision. So this pushback was rather immediate, very technical, coming from the top, and not just the state of Virginia, but they led the massive resistance. So a lot of what we see now, I think, is just a continuation of what they started in ways around things. You know, making sure, I know Brown 3, I don't know if you're aware that was a Brown 3. The Brown 1 was Earl Warren's pronouncement of the unanimous decision of 54. Brown 2 was May of 1955, when the court reconvened to give the country its direction for implementation with all deliberate speed. And I'm sure everybody out there, if you know what the word deliberate means, it means slow. And not just normal slow, we're talking painstakingly slow, which perhaps there was a message embedded in that. And then Brown 3 was something that happened again only in Topeka in the mid-1970s. But the whole point of this is people who wanted to defy the court's decision have not stopped. I've learned by watching all of this that Supreme Court decisions are just the beginning of a conversation. Those that win are happy, excited, talking about victory and implementation. Those that lose are busy strategizing to obstruct, overturn at all cost. And if you go back and look at Supreme Court decisions, you'll see that is in fact the case. Brown was no different. So the conversation on the losing side has led us to a lot of what we see today. I think it was on MSNBC on the 18th that evening, and the gentleman that was the host talked about a group of white citizens in Louisiana that were trying to secede from New Orleans so they could have their own school district as well. That would be, in fact, white children only. So this has not stopped. And you know what saddened me about what I see in Florida and Oklahoma and Mississippi and, you know, it's merging in Kansas and other places, is if you deny children the opportunity to learn about the experiences of other people, how on earth are they going to develop empathy? So will we have an entire generation that will be even more me-focused than they are now? I mean, it's a frightening thought. The governor of Mississippi stepped to the mic, talked about how she was looking to replicate what the state of Florida was doing. Then she went on and said, in this state, we are not going to support the teaching of divisive concepts. I am not a divisive concept. Now, the history of people of color in this country is not a divisive concept, but the buzzword she used was what my mother used to call nice nasty. You know, when you're saying something nice, but within that phrase is a whole lot of nasty. So to suggest that teaching about people that were born LGBTQ or people that are people of color are divisive concepts. So we need to be very vigilant about what started right after Brown and what hasn't stopped. And in looking at the big picture, and I give young people the example, although I've got to come up with a better example, if anybody has one. There used to be a television show called Under the Dome. It was Stephen King, I think, and it was that people lived under this dome. The example I would give them, okay, African Americans living under the dome, but when you open the door of that dome and step out, you know, your rights were abridged, you couldn't eat in restaurants, you couldn't try on clothing, your life could be threatened. You couldn't live your entire life under the dome. So the bigger picture was Brown v. Board. Schools were the battlefront, but society at large was, in fact, the target. So in terms of pushback in Topeka, the letters that went out the year before, one of the plaintiffs asserted there was a group of young white men that circled her block once. But there wasn't any pushback, and I think because people were already living around one another, already socially associating. So we didn't have the same issues of South Carolina and Virginia and Little Rock in Topeka. So I started school that next fall, in the fall of 1955. But my sister Terry, our middle sister, is the only one in our family that started school in an integrated setting. So it's been an interesting experience. And, you know, I compare my mom and sister's experience to my own, because going to their reunions, it was like a big family reunion. The teachers would be there, even the truant officer, which is something people don't have anymore. Everybody was there, and it was just so, all the camaraderie and the goodwill. And then I started that next year, 1955, kindergarten through graduate school, never had a teacher of color. My experience was quite different. The example I give is the lessons I learned, or perhaps not so much the lessons of uplift, you know, that was taught daily in the segregated schools. The lesson I learned was that education is a very intimate process, meaning it's 100% on you. Teachers can guide, they can encourage, they can direct, but becoming an educated person depends on you. So being in school, kindergarten through graduate school, never having a teacher of color, always having white teachers, some that made it clear that they were not entirely pleased with my presence, some that had absolutely no expectations for me, you know, was an amazing lesson for me to understand that if I was going to do this thing of education, then it was up to me. So very different lessons than my mothers and sisters had. But 38,000 African-American teachers across the South lost their job. So not only did the Topeka superintendent send out letters of threat, it happened in real time by the thousands across the South as schools integrated. But we didn't have that kind of pushback in terms of any violence or in Topeka.
You're listening to Think Twice on WYSO. Today we're featuring a conversation from the Dayton Metro Library's Social Justice Speaker Series. Dr. Carlos Marshall interviews Cheryl Brown Henderson. The conversation will continue after this break.
Hi, I'm Nina Ellis. Another new podcast is coming from WISO. It's called The Ohio Country. It's about the tribal nations of Ohio, past, present, and future. Join us for the most important Ohio story you may not know.
Support for The Ohio Country comes from Ohio Humanities.
And you talked about after the Brown versus Board Supreme Court decision that you then went to school that following school year. So with this all occurring as being such a young person, how did you, with your own personal journey, how did you come to be aware of your family's involvement in this?
Awareness takes a certain level of maturity. So it wasn't until probably my late 20s, even early 30s, that I became mature enough to really want to understand better. My father died in 1961. I think you heard that in the bio. He died suddenly, 42 years old, and I was 10. So at 10 years old, you know, you certainly don't have an interest, understanding, or even awareness of that being our surname, you know, on a Supreme Court decision. My sister Linda was 18, my sister Terry was 14. My mom was a quintessential 1950s homemaker. So we're talking about a woman who now had three girls and was without her spouse. So Brown v. Board was never talked about in our home. It was not dinner table conversation. It wasn't top of mind, as they say now. So it really took my finishing college and grad school, and at that point I'd become a state educational administrator and was doing OCR reviews about, you know, issues of disability at the time. But that also led me to the civil rights impact of Brown v. Board and starting to research and learn. That's how I discovered the 11 cases that were in the annals of the Kansas Supreme Court Library. So it took some time. Now the one glimmer I had, although it didn't register, when my father died, we were living in Missouri. He was at his second church at the time, Benton Avenue AME Church in Springfield, Missouri. So mother moved us all back to Topeka in with my her parents. And so one day I'm coming home from junior high school. This is 1964, the 10th anniversary of Brown v. Board. So as I get closer to the house, there's a white man standing on the porch. Now, you know, the white folks lived in our neighborhood, but it wasn't a white man I recognized. So I was sort of reticent, in coming close to him. He stuck out his hand and he said, "Hi, my name is Charles Kuralt, and I'm here with a show called On the Road with Charles Kuralt for CBS. We're doing a story about the 10th anniversary of Brown v. Board." Okay. So I said, "Nice to meet you, Mr. Kuralt." Went inside with, you know, cameras and wires and everything, and 13 years old, you know, you walk right past that onto my room where the door closed, the way I liked it. So I wasn't concerned about what was going on in the rest of the house. So it took that maturity to really understand, you know, what happened, who was involved, and all of the details. But I will say you, the disinformation that I mentioned earlier, and the thing about not telling your own story, it wasn't until the 80s that we discovered, actually, we had a family meeting. I was explaining to the family what I believed happened. Because in 1987, Life magazine published a special issue on the Constitution. That was an aha moment. The aha moment was the realization that it was Life magazine that created the myth that Brown was all about the Brown family, that Brown was all about Linda Brown, Brown was all about Oliver Brown, her father. Because they sent a photographer to Topeka in 1953, and he took photos around town. You know, he knew it was a class action. He saw the buildings. But somebody made an editorial decision. Because the media likes simplicity sometimes. And so the focus was all on our family when it hit the magazine. Back then, Life magazine was like Twitter, X, Facebook, Instagram, whatever else is out there. If it was in Life magazine, it had to be the truth. So for 70 years, we've lived with somebody's editorial decision. And there's still textbooks in this country. There's still people that believe what Life magazine intentionally, mistakenly, or trying to make something compelling placed on our shoulders. So that's how it ended up being known the way it's known. So the work we do at the Brown Foundation is all about pushing aside that et al. Any attorneys in the audience? Those are scary little letters because it relegates hundreds of people to legal wasteland. They become historic footnotes. So we were determined that would not happen to the plaintiffs in Brown. So pushing aside the et al. And talking about the Briggs plaintiffs and getting together with them several times a year. And we all go off together to these big events, the plaintiffs in Delaware and Virginia and South Carolina and so on. They need to be known because their sacrifice was, as the Briggs plaintiffs would explain, much greater. Aftermath, for example, in Virginia. We know about Little Rock, Arkansas, schools being closed for a year. Most people are not aware that schools were closed for 5 years in Farmville, Virginia. They're learning now, because as we have been pushing this for the last 40 years, you know, it's starting to take some root, you know, it's starting to get out there that Brown is all of these cases and all these people and these things happen to them. So the example I like to give about Virginia is if you are in third grade, you're 8 years old generally in third grade, schools close. 5 years later, schools reopen. You're now 13. Do you go back to third grade? No. So I've been to Farmville, Virginia several times. One of the things that happened, white academies, they call them segregationist academies, sprung up. Federal money funneled into those places. For African Americans, if you couldn't afford to send your child out of the county, there was no school. For whites who were not very affluent, there was no school. So there are people there to this day, now aging, that are still upset with this country, denying them 5 years of their education for no other reason, but as an example of how determined the majority population has been to hang on to power and privilege, you would go to those lengths, closing schools for 5 years. I mean, that's really something. So that to me, that's the most egregious, I think, of all the pushback.
Certainly, you talk about the closures of schools. Previously, you stated about the tens of thousands of African-American teachers that lost their job. You also alluded to the fact with Topeka, Kansas, being to a certain degree socially integrated at a time that there were also folks that, black families that were not concerned with integrated and desegregated schools. So I'm wondering if you could speak to what is the current status of academic achievement of black students in Topeka, Kansas? And do you believe in, and what would you say to somebody that would argue that desegregation adversely impacted black children?
Yeah, first of all, I agree, because I think no one anticipated, you know, these are unanticipated consequences of Brown, and there were many. And no one anticipated, you know, the nature of the pushback. So when you look at public education and the rhetoric that is now emerging, failing underfunded public schools, you know, which is totally insane when you collectively consider the resources available to the public. My response is, the focus still has to be education with the capital E. Teachers need to educate, and I'm sure they feel this way, the children that show up. Let's let the policymakers worry about counting heads. There's no reason why, if I'm a student in a school predominated by students of color, that it still should be a world-class experience. There's no reason, none. If I'm in a school that's dominated by Latina students, it should still be a world-class institution. We oftentimes fall prey to propaganda, and we don't get into the weeds of what's really being said. Propaganda is one of the most powerful tools of any government at any level. More powerful than anything. If you can convince people of something, you have power over them. So my position on this is, first of all, Earl Warren read the wrong part of the opinion, in my view. The opinion is 14 pages long, not this few sentences of, in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. You know, separate educational facilities are inherently unequal. And then it went on to say that segregating African-American children under the weight of law creates a badge of inferiority in ways never to be undone. I don't agree with any of that. The other part of the opinion that comes before that statement is this. He says, the court said, education is the most important act of state and local governments. No child can be expected to succeed in life without the benefit of an education. And where it is provided is a right, they use the word right, that must be made available to all on equal terms. The significance of education is what he should have started with, in my view. Because when he talked about the separation, the inequality in separate facilities, he used the word inferior. You know, segregationists were probably, you know, partying, because that gave them a focus. Now, we can make sure we fight to keep these things separate. We want to make sure we fight to assign this badge of inferiority, which is not a word you use with people. It's a retail word. Inferior products, not people. There's no way people can be inferior, because I don't care who you are, we all got here the same way. We were all born. There are no exceptions. So there's no such thing as anybody better than anybody else, you know, unless you came here from another planet that we don't know about. But it's just ludicrous to think that our beginnings are 100% the same in terms of our emergence, but it's all of the propaganda and mistreatment that happens once we're here that creates that sense of some being more privileged than others. So I really wish it started out with that, with the significance of education, so that we could get back to what we're supposed to be doing, which is educating, so that we can have an informed citizenry, so that people can have the ability to achieve to the best of their ability, you know, without obstruction. Because a lot of this is artificial barriers. It is intentional that there are schools that are failing and underfunded. But we're asking the wrong questions, I think. So I subscribe to the notion that it doesn't matter who's in the classroom as long as education is taking place there.
Talking about people wielding political propaganda, I think there's a lot of concern around the country in terms of the regression of equal rights. And when you talk about the opinions of coming down from the courts, language absolutely matters. And you talked previously about the Southern Manifesto, in which congressmen from the South said that they would do everything in their power to repeal that decision. Many believe that we're now seeing the fruits of their labor with the repeal of affirmative action, Roe v. Wade. And so when we're talking about shaping language and discourse through media, as well as the language of the Supreme Court, I want to ask you specifically about something that Clarence Thomas has recently noted in saying, because the Southern Manifesto really was indicating that there was a judicial overreach. And now Clarence Thomas is noted in saying that that Supreme Court decision of Brown v. Board had a boundless view of equitable remedies. And he said that federal courts do not have, and I quote, the flexible power to invent whatever new remedies may seem useful at the time, end quote. So with that being said, is there any fear from you and the other families that Brown v. Board is in any way in harm of being repealed in any time in the near future or our lifetime?
No, that's an excellent question. We've had those conversations about, you know, are we next for the chopping block? And I find it interesting that Justice Thomas would steer clear of Loving v. Virginia when it was advantageous for him. He could marry someone that considered to be of another race. So I find it concerning, because with this particular court, and his statement illustrates that, and some of the flag upside down thing that we've been hearing about illustrates that it's hard to separate the person from their agenda. It's hard to separate the person from their biases. And we'd like to think that the law is a shield against injustice. People of color know that the law has been used to perpetrate injustice. So it's troubling to me when it seems so obvious that he is speaking to those from whom he has been able to engender, that's the wrong word, but to benefit. And it's troubling to me that a person of color who was put on the Supreme Court basically to replace Thurgood Marshall would speak in that manner. Because if nothing more, having respect for Justice Marshall and the legacy he left, that you were then, upon his death, being confirmed to replace. So you have to ask yourself, and I'm beginning to think that we need to have, within the vetting, there needs to be psychoanalysis. And let's not just vet looking at their tax records, but we need to get up here and make sure that they're going to be the kind of thinkers. They're going to be the kind of people that will respect the rule of law and have fidelity to the law and not be caught up in their own agendas, because I'm afraid that we are seeing law decision being dispensed by people with chips on their shoulder. Not only is it not a good look, it's detrimental to the country. I would encourage all of you, and I've done it a few times, you can go to the United States Supreme Court website, go down the list of any case, click on that, and you can listen to the oral arguments. I listened to the UNC argument months ago, and Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson was new to the court at the time. But what was so stellar about her being there as a new person, and you know, sometimes when you're new, you know, you think, okay, that I'm gonna not only show them what I know, but I'm going to speak up. You know, I'm going to be that kind of justice, a full participant on the court. I'm listening to this argument. She called them when one of them, who shall remain nameless, asserted that the Constitution was not a race-conscious document. Her pushback was, wait a minute, 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution, we're all about race. So we cannot sit here on this bench asserting that the Constitution is not a race-conscious document, since we're arguing a race-conscious case. Then she went on to say, what you're asking in UNC, let's say her example was, I'm a black child in North Carolina. Generations of my family since slavery have been here. I've always wanted to go to UNC, but now you're telling me I cannot write this down that I'm an African-American person with, or even leaving that out, just saying that generations of my family have been here since, you know, starting with enslavement. I've always wanted to somehow identify that I'm a person of color. I'm supposed to deny myself. I'm supposed to somehow step out of my skin, my experiences, my culture, my beliefs, deny my family in order to be accepted by UNC, because you're saying that they cannot consider my experiences and my race. So do listen, by the way. I'm encouraging you to do that. It is worth listening. But what also strikes me is when you think about that kind of argument, you think about DeSantis in Florida, and you think about the woman down in Mississippi, the governor, and you think about the people in all these different states. To me, they are on a campaign to codify white supremacy. Because if you cannot learn about anyone else, if you cannot speak the word segregation, if you cannot speak the word discrimination, if you cannot speak the words based on race, what else could the mission be? In Florida, DeSantis is permitting or authorized the use of these 5-minute videos from Dennis Prager, his online Prager University, which is not a university at all. He's a right-wing radio talk show host. Prager University. And he's developed these 5-minute videos. I looked at a few, and then I needed some Pepto. Sickening. Every one of them ends with the message of the benevolence of the majority population. You tell me that's not an attempt to codify white supremacy, so that everybody, regardless of ethnicity or gender or race, will believe it. He actually said, yes, this is indoctrination. But indoctrinating children with the right thing, when he has one video that talks about Frederick Douglass agreeing with slavery as an acceptable compromise, I would encourage you to look at them, as many as you can tolerate. it's just shocking to me that, you know, we would, first of all, market them to school districts, and I'm sure Florida is not the only state that has agreed this could be shown in a classroom. But it is absolutely, it's not even revisionist history, just straight up lying. Let's call it what it is. But those are the kinds of challenges we now see. So it's no longer being blatant about keeping children of color out of spaces where they want only white children to be. But it's also about trying to then indoctrinate them into believing, you know, that perhaps they are inferior. Because we've got these little videos over here that show the only benevolent people, the only ones that have done anything, the only ones that saved the day, don't look like you. So, you know, there's a lot to be concerned about, you know, in the scheme of things, because the kind of focus groups these people put together, I'm not sure I'd even want to be a fly on the wall to hear these conversations. Because who comes up with this? Who is so evil to push that kind of agenda on the country? So we have a lot to worry about come November. I mean, nothing small. We're talking major, cataclysmic stuff to worry about.
Want to personally thank you and send gratitude for you to continue fighting the fight on behalf and amongst all of us, the work of your father, your mother, your entire family, all of the families that were part of that case. We truly do stand on y'all's shoulders. So with that said, as you mentioned before, your father was not able to see the impacts of that decision. So now being just 13 days removed from marking 70 years, if he was here today, what do you think he would have to say?
Well, I think he would agree with me that being a United States citizen is not a spectator sport. It is not. You know, you really have to step up and be engaged. You know, I used to chair a women's organization where we would read legislation. And it taught me something that my father would agree with, that you cannot take the word of the person that you voted for. You need to get into the weeds and find out if what they are saying, you know, is in fact what this bill contains. You know, what they are saying will in fact have the impact, an impact that will make your life better. We would read legislation that wouldn't resemble the buzzwords. President, example, H.W. Bush would always come out and talk about the Civil Rights Restoration Act. And he would talk about, he didn't want to sign a quota bill. Well, when we read it, it was a bill about women in the workplace mainly. Certain level of remuneration. Created the Glass Ceiling Commission. It was not a quota bill. The word quota wasn't even in the margins. But unless you read it or asked questions, you would support the fact, you know, black folks didn't want to be considered quotas. The little focus groups that they put together of blue-collar white men, and they asked the question, what pushes your button when it comes to civil rights? Quotas, which gave him the buzzword to use. Now, there's so many things that happen with politics at every level that it behooves you to have a greater understanding of. There's nothing that prohibits you from going to school board meetings. There's nothing that keeps you from going to city council meetings. There's nothing that keeps you from, you know, reading federal legislation. What people count on in power is that you won't. We need to prove them wrong. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening to a conversation between Cheryl Brown Henderson, daughter of Brown versus Board of Education lead plaintiff Oliver Brown, and Dr. Carlos Marshall, Dayton Metro Library's Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Director. The conversation was part of Dayton Metro Library's Social Justice Speakers Series. To watch an unedited version of this event, visit Dayton Metro Library's YouTube channel. Special thanks to Aaron Smith and Jeffrey Opt at Dayton Metro Library. For Think Twice on WYSO, I'm Dave Barber. Thanks for listening.